You get Syria, I get Yemen, or you get your hands off Syria, I get my hands off Yemen. So there's that happening. And I think that dynamic is over and above other things that have to do with the United States and other topics. In fact, there is talk now. I mean, I don't know. These things could be reversed. That, you know, one of the countries that's one of the actors that's not happy about what's happening is Israel, because Saudi Arabia was moving in a particular direction fast, very fast. And now I'm not sure if it's reversed that direction, but it's also moving in another direction. And I'm not one of those people who feel that this is not going to be reversed. I think this might actually, I'm one of the people who thinks this might be temporary. The entire Chinese involvement, the Iran, Saudi Arabia connection, I am not as confident as others in its durability.
It seems that some of the more, you know, countries that are less likely to join the Abraham Accords, like, or to normalize with Israel, like Indonesia, Malaysia, even Pakistan, there are voices within those countries that are calling for normalization. And I'm wondering if it's not just a safe bet for the regime in Syria to join that.
Oh, I mean,
it wouldn't be a safe thing for them to do.
I don't think, I see what you're, okay. I don't think the regime's decision-making is autonomous. It wasn't autonomous to begin with years ago. It was connected to other considerations. But today, on these questions, it's certainly not autonomous. So it's not whether the regime wants or doesn't want. It's close allies, those who have actually literally saved it, will have a say. And I don't think this formula is on the cards, is in the cards. I don't think, I mean, I would be happy to be proven, not happy, actually, I wouldn't be very happy at all to be proven wrong, but I'll accept to be proven wrong. But I'll be extremely surprised if, because the Abraham Accords, I mean, have you read them?
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What we are listening to is the question and answer session that followed the lecture delivered by Professor Bassam Haddad titled Navigating Anti-Imperialism and Anti-Authoritarianism, the Syrian Uprising and the Question of Palestine. Bassam Haddad is an associate professor at the Shor School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He delivered that lecture on May 24, 2023 at the annual Hisham Sharabi Memorial Lecture hosted by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. I had aired that lecture during the previous episode of Arab Voices, and it is already archived on our website, arabvoices.net. Let's continue listening to the remaining questions and answers that followed the lecture.
I think almost everybody in the world was horrified by what happened in Syria and this just slow motion destruction and utter, you know, torture of the people. You know, Obama should have never let the Russians, you know, fight in the Middle East. But, I'm interested that you think that, you know, you actually do believe that that the jihadis or the, you know, extremists had kind of taken over the movement, because I really wasn't very sure about that. Another thing that I
think, on the battlefield, I always reference the battlefield, mm-hmm. on the battlefield, yeah.
But another thing that I really wonder if how much of it played a part in it was the experience in Iraq, because Syria was the only place in the world where a brutal Shiite leadership ruled a large Sunni majority of populace. And, there really was a possibility that if that Assad had been overthrown, that there would have been a real serious massacre in that country and probably, you know, partially supported by all the Sunni countries around it. And how much do you think that was, you know, maybe a contributor to the inaction of America and really the entire world, where we just watched these, you know, these people just be bombed to whatever. And by the way, I'm a Russian expert, but I think the whole creation of the refugee crisis was part of the design, you know, to drive million people out, you know, into Europe and promote the neo-fascist parties and stuff that all love Putin.
There's a lot going on in your question. And there are some terms that I think are not accurate, such as the Syrian regime is predominantly at the very top, not all, but predominantly is Alawis, not Shi'i. And Alawism doesn't rule Syria, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons, one of the things that are, I think, are misnomers, even though they have disproportional influence, but they don't, basically, in Syria, you don't have Alawi, pro-Alawi policies, right? Alawi communities are as impoverished and in many ways repressed as many others. But yes, the ruling class is disproportionately Alawi. So the sectarian argument is something that I don't support. And I also don't support that if there was a takeover by the opposition, that there will be a massacre of Alawi. I don't support these narratives. I mean, it's also a narrative that we hear in other places, such as Israel. I don't think there will be a massacre. And it all depends, of course, on who is replacing the regime, but things are not as simple. I think that's a narrative that the regime or regime supporters more so peddle in order to scare people into supporting the regime. I think things are much more complex than that. And at the same time, if there is a replacement or if there is an overthrow, things are far less dramatic than what this narrative suggests. But I there's a lot in the premise of what you shared that I don't support. So in all cases, I don't see things in sectarian terms, and I don't see those outcomes as I don't see the problem as such. The problem is mainly, in my view, that the uprising in Syria is a legitimate uprising, or the issue is it's a legitimate uprising that was thwarted. So, and then from there, that's when imperialism, or, and I put this in quotation marks because people have been different things by it, played a role. But in terms of the designs and in terms of how everything was designed decades ago, I'm not a big fan of this rhetoric. Because every political actor uses design, the question of designs, to its advantage. And I don't think we have designs anymore. People, it's obvious what countries are doing. The US invaded and destroyed an entire country, Iraq, in 2003. There were no designs. I mean, it just wanted to do what it did for reasons that were evident. It wanted to remake the Middle East in ways that supports its own politics and the politics of its allies. So I'm not very big on these on some of these designs schemes. I think Rama had a question earlier.
Oh, thank you, Bassam. Two questions. One related to Syrian question of Palestine. If you can speak to the impact of the revolution and counter-revolution on Palestinian refugee communities within Syria. And then the second one is kind of related to the problems of discourse that we were talking to throughout your talk. I think one particular one, and it relates to maybe it's hard to have hope in this moment, in this part, you know, with Bashar being accepted in the league, the country destroyed. But I think part of what's been frustrating the last decade or so is that so much conversation is about the military, the geopolitics, and many times that just gets the attention. And so the on the ground, what people are doing day to day, both, you know, in the immediate of the uprising, but also lasted several years through into doesn't get as much attention. And how does that then impact then the way we are able to relate when it just becomes, it's too big of a problem, it's geopolitics, I can't engage in this.
So can you just summarize the second point, like what you want me to address, just so I don't misunderstand?
Just in terms of like what it means when the discourse also becomes so much into the military and the battleground and the geopolitics at the expense of what I think is more hopeful in terms of how people are continuing to survive day to day and organize on the ground.
I mean, very quickly, the Palestinian refugees in Syria, of course, like all Syrians, frankly, have actually been subject to the same context of repression, of economic destitution and decline and all of that prior to the uprising. And I didn't see that there is a significant difference between these communities inside Syria and the rest of Syrians in general. You would find actually people among them that had a different take on the transformation of or the change that took place within the uprising, because some people don't like the word transformation and the change in direction. But I don't think that there is a significant difference between the reaction of the refugees compared to Palestinian refugees in Syria compared to the rest of Syrians. So it could be that based on micro studies, one can actually get a bit deeper, but there's nothing that jumps at you in terms of a statistically significant difference. The problem, of course, is that, you know, people that are twice and thrice displaced, they're going to always be under that much more duress and so on. On the other question, I mean, this is what I'm trying to say. The principal hero and victim in all of this are the Syrian people who made sure that they kept their towns and neighborhoods and families alive throughout this, which is something that was completely absent from the media because it was not a sensational thing to cover. But these are the people that actually give hope. And the better or more optimistic development in Syria is that those, and I shared this in the talk, is that those who, including Alawi communities, by the way, that at the time sided with the regime, not all because they support the regime, but also because, but primarily because they don't like the alternative, are now actually extremely resentful. And there is a sense that if there is a go again, that the social and political learning that took place at all levels, unfortunately also at the regime's level, is going to be in play. But the positive thing about this is that the regime played its cards right in terms of pursuing what it pursued in the most problematic manner, in the most reprehensible manner, but it was able to do that, except that the opposition and many of us didn't. And I think we are to benefit from a reproduction of these circumstances, which everyone now might wonder when this might happen again, not just in the case of Syria, but also in the case of Egypt, for instance, and so on. In my view, as somebody who follows the region and studies it and teaches it and writes about it, I don't think this is happening very soon, at least not in a collective manner across countries. But there is, in my view, a very important task for all of us, and that is to begin establishing forms of solidarity and joint struggle. First of all, that blur boundaries and borders. And that is something that, unfortunately, if you look at what's happening, is not being done. And maybe it's being done within countries, but even within countries, even in the case of Syria, if you look at the NGOization of various pro-human rights or human rights-oriented groups, everything is happening at a level that is compartmentalized. And I unfortunately think this is this doesn't bode well for another circumstance where these conditions reproduce the need to go to the streets, the need to actually and the capacity to do this. But you know, I'm very hopeful that people are aware that if this indeed does happen again, you will see a very different behavior among not just those who are the natural dissenters, but also among those who, for whatever reason, tried to stick with the devil they knew. And unfortunately, what you are seeing at the level of states and the welcoming back of Syria, and by the way, it's not like Syria is now being welcomed back to Disneyland, it's the Arab League. So it's not like that far off from Syria, although it is far off in some ways. But I'm hopeful, theoretically, but in practice, I don't think we're seeing as much movement as we'd like in that direction that you mentioned.
Well, since we're in the Palestine center, I thought we would focus more on how the Syrian war has affected the Palestinians. There was quite a large population of Palestinians in Syria. I think it was about 400,000, and they were very well constituted. They had access to social services, education, and employment. So I have two questions. What is the status of the Palestine community today in Syria, and if Assad got overthrown, would that whole support axis from Iran through a little bit of Iraq all the way to Hezbollah in Lebanon be interrupted? And would that be sort of fatal to the Palestinian people?
I mean, I already addressed this. I don't think there is a vast difference between the conditions of Palestinians inside Syria and the rest of Syrians, not because of some sort of philosophy of equity, even though the Syrian regime and the prior one have actually treated Palestinians in a far more equitable manner than, say, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And that's because, and the reason why there's not much difference is because everyone in Syria is now, I mean, we're talking about 60 to 80%, depending on what you look at in terms of the source of statistics, are living under the poverty line. So there isn't much leeway there in terms of addressing differences. As to the second point, in terms of Syria's, you know, if the regime disappears or is overthrown, what does this do to the Palestine question? Well, let's start with what this does to Iran. And in many ways, the collapse or the failure or the overthrow of the Syrian regime would certainly isolate Iran in ways that are very significant. And if Iran is isolated, then its support for Hezbollah is going to lack the linchpin and the channel through which Iran arms and supports Hezbollah. So that's going to be a huge blow for that country and its politics, whatever these may be, and the connection with Hezbollah. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people were interested in sustaining the Syrian regime, not because of its own sake, but because of what this camp could serve in terms of a balance of power with Israel. Now, this narrative could be a bit inaccurate. My take could be a bit inaccurate, but no one can deny that this camp is now the only camp militarily that poses any threat to the state of Israel or a deterrence to the state of Israel, including Israeli military officials as well as military journalists and scholars.
The last question is from Jihad Abu Salem, executive director of the Palestine Center that organized the event.
I have one more question, and we can conclude after that if it's okay with everyone. I guess I get to have my one question. So this is a sore subject, and usually like the mood isn't like this in the room when we have events about Palestine, talking about, you know, resistance on the ground or the reality of Palestine or bringing uplifting stories. And I think it's the role of spaces like this is to also have uncomfortable conversations. And I believe that this is the, you know, this is very important, not because, you know, not because we only care about Palestine, but we also care about our neighbors and our Arab brothers and sisters and about the region. And we don't want to see countries falling apart. We don't want to see civil wars. We don't want to see these things happening. However, do you think after more than a decade of what we have witnessed since the beginning of the Arab uprisings, do you think there is a... Because I want to talk a little bit about agency within the context of these states, within the context of these decision makers, within the context of these countries. Do you think there these regimes, these governments that not only Syria, where I'm trying to, you know, to zoom out a little bit, do you think they learned any lessons on how to avoid getting in situations like the ones we've witnessed throughout the past decade or more? And by that, I mean, some of the arguments that we heard in the past decade or so in approaching the Arab uprisings, and in a comparative sense, meaning that, you know, comparing different countries and the different outcomes that we've witnessed, geopolitics aside, and of course, you know, the interests of outside forces aside, there was a number of Arab intellectuals argued that the more the political space was eliminated within a given country, the more there was a tendency for that country to devolve into that kind of nihilistic, destructive rabbit hole of mutual destruction and the tendency to unleash forces of violence and so on and so forth. Can we say that the existing regimes, whether they were regimes that survived the last decade or regimes that, you know, came, that rose to power as a result of the last decade, are they capable of learning that lesson? Are they capable of understanding that the more these political spaces are eliminated, the more there is an ability for elites, not in the, you know, like elitist sense, but as, you know, like leaders within the country, communities within a given country, the civil society, political parties, political forces to engage in processes of bargaining, of creating, of engaging in decision making that would spare these countries having to go through civil wars and civil strife? Can we say that this lesson has been learned? And what is the role, what is our role as intellectuals, academics, scholars who are interested in the region in creating different ways, different modes of thinking that would allow for that thinking to exist?
Thank you. That's a lot. But let me just try to summarize what I'm assuming you're getting at by saying that what we've learned and what Arab states have learned, because they're smart, despite what people think, they're smart, they know how to stay on top. What we've learned is that the forces of counter-revolution are much stronger than the forces of revolution in the Global South specifically. And this has taken place as a result of the intertwining of intervention slash imperialism, called what you will, on the one hand, and authoritarianism on the other, because they, as I shared, which is not something that I dealt into because this would have been much longer, they have actually benefited one another and reinforced one another. So what we've learned is that the forces of counter-revolution are far greater, and the tools available to them in terms of economics, in terms of financial support, in terms of weaponry, in terms of the ability strategically and otherwise to thwart movements, in terms of their ability to muddle and play a particular game that presents the lesser evil as desirable, thereby returning back to what was the status quo. These are the sorts of things that we've learned in terms of the power of counter-revolution. If you look at the cases that started in 2011, experiencing mass protests, Syria is back with the Syrian regime in a much of a destitute country, but that actually is a situation where you have a return to the status quo in a much more ugly manner. If you look at Egypt, despite the Egyptian media that sings the praises of Sisi and the Egyptian regime, we also have the return to the status quo that is much worse than the prior status quo, because the prior status quo was one where you understood that it's a repressive regime that has no democratic legitimacy, whereas this one presents itself as being based on popular, some sort of a popular democratic support. And it's a regime that actually tolerates dissent far less. If you look at Bahrain, which lasted a very short period because of the intervention of Saudi Arabia and the silence of Europe and the United States vis-a-vis this intervention, because they don't want that to cause a domino effect, that situation in Bahrain to cause a domino effect in the Arab Gulf for obvious reasons. So we do have a return to the status quo, and that return is a testimony to the importance of that dynamic between authoritarian rule and international intervention, how they reinforce one another. Now, in terms of our role, I mean, I keep getting asked this question. Anybody who speaks keeps getting asked this question, what can we do? I don't know. I mean, of course, there's a lot that we can do. But the one thing that I always see myself saying is that let's not just wait until crisis erupt for us to basically say something. When Israel bombs Gaza to smithereens, we all get angry and become active in those 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, things move on and, you know, we're done. Even with the Twitter, with tweeting and being on social media, even that becomes more reduced after. There is a need for us to actually, as someone said, and I'm not going to quote them because they changed course. I don't know what's up with people changing course in this world, but I want to quote this person. And he said, there is no alternative to organizing. There is no alternative to organizing. So we can do a lot as individuals, and that's wonderful, but there's no alternative to organizing with each other, but also build bridges with people with similar goals, similar causes that are not people that look like you, that talk like you, or that have the, you know, basically the same background. I think there is, in my talk, a serious critique, which I didn't develop on purpose, of the manner in which the world is organized today, the international state system. And I think one of the things that most of us can do is to actually reach beyond the borders of a nation state, but also, unfortunately, right, to also connect within the people that are within your nation state and organize. Those of us who live in the United States, as opposed to, for instance, people who live in Syria, have the freedom to actually organize and to connect and to build bridges so that the next time something happens, we are operating on a much more sound basis of collective action, of collective understanding. And if there is one thing that we all can do and we have not done in during the uprising, especially with sensitive cases, is to try a bit harder not to just undermine each other, because we have some differences in the way we approach the same goal that we believe in. And that's something that I think would actually have been more effective in supporting or critiquing or putting things on the right path, at least discursively. But I honestly see that there are limits to what we can do as individuals without organizing, without institutions, and without collective action within where we're at and across various settings. And that's basically like saying little, but you're asking a very big question. And I think big questions, you know, don't have really good answers.
And despite that, we have had a great conversation tonight. Professor Bassam Haddad, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
What you just heard was the question and answer session that followed the lecture delivered by Professor Bassam Haddad, titled Navigating Anti-Imperialism and Anti-Authoritarianism, the Syrian Uprising and the Question of Palestine. Bassam Haddad is an associate professor at the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He delivered that lecture on May 24, 2023, at the annual Hisham Sharabi Memorial Lecture hosted by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. I aired that lecture during the previous episode of Arab Voices, and it is already archived on our website, arabvoices.net. For more information about the Palestine Center, visit the organization's website, and that's www.thejerusalemfund.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
رادیو قاصدک هر روز دوشنبه بین ساعت 5 تا 6 بعد از ظهر روی موج FM 97.5 مگاهرتز از فرستنده رادیو لورا از شهر زوریخ
یک ساعت برنامه شاد و متنوع به همراه بهترین نواهای فارسی.
برای دوام این فرستنده لطفاً کمک‌های مالی خودتون رو از رادیو لورا دریغ نکنید.
شماره حساب رادیو لورا برای کمک‌های مالی شما 80 خط تیره 14 403 خط تیره 9.